Hello, friends. It's Emmy, and this is another episode of Stems and Leaves, a show where we talk about intersectional stories in STEM. First off, my apologies for the delay in getting this piece up. Life has been coming at me very fast, and graduation is now only 7 weeks away. And I've been just not doing all the things I've been supposed to do. But I'm so excited to share this episode. My guest is Jason Piles, who is referred to by he/him pronouns. We've been acquainted for a while virtually. Jason was assigned as a mentor for me through the Eurissa Match Program. And he's just been such a great friend and supporter and encourager via email. And this episode, this recording, is actually our first quote-unquote face-to-face conversation. We did record the session via Skype, so there are a few things that were cut for time because of wonky audio and tech failures, but Jason shared some great stories, and from the over 2 hours of recorded content, we got it down to this kind of quick and clean episode. Still a bit longer than most, but I couldn't bear to cut some of this stuff. It's just so great. So I hope you enjoy what Jason has to share. Here's the episode. If you tuned in last episode, you know that this semester I'm producing a few GIS and geography-specific topic episodes. One of the ones that I mentioned was rural planning. And today I'm pleased to have a guest on the show, Jason Piles. Jason and I have been acquainted for a year and a half.
I think that's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, about a year and a half now. And we've never formally met in person. We had a chance at Ohio GIS, but being a student, I had to dip out of there for a little bit, and we just missed paths a couple times. Jason has been my mentor through the Eurissa group, and so he has been involved, like, looking over my academic career and my internships, and just being a wise voice to some of the angst and pains I've been feeling as a student, and very validating about a lot of the questions I ask. And so today he's come on the show as our guest expert in rural planning. So hey there, Jason.
Hi. Before I even introduce myself, I want to say thank you for the kind words, because I feel wildly underqualified to mentor you in some aspects. Some of that may become clear as I tell my own story here. Yes, I'm Jason Piles. I am the GIS coordinator for Buckeye Hills Regional Council down here in southeastern Ohio. I'm going to throw a lot of jargon out here. Hopefully I can explain it well enough. We're a council of governments, which is an association that consists of elected officials, public officials from the communities that we serve, which is 8 counties here in southeastern Ohio. That's Athens, Hocking, Meigs, Monroe, Morgan, Noble, Perry, and Washington. All those counties are defined as Appalachian by the federal government's Appalachian Regional Commission. And so for some further context, they range from about like 14,000, just over 65,000 people in each county. That's pretty darn rural. We've got some small cities and villages. None of those has more than 25,000 people.
Okay. We're working with definitely rural, 100%.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So I find that many people have sort of a skewed idea of what they think of as small. Like 100,000 people is a small town. And it's like, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
I'm the sort of the head GIS person for this agency, covers these counties, serves their governments.
Let's talk about you a little bit. I am curious about your academic background, because we made those introductions back when we started our mentor-mentee relationship, because you came to Ohio State. Yes. As part of the same scholarship program that I'm currently a part of. What did you study, and how did you kind of take this winding path back to your rural roots?
Well, okay, let's talk about that. So I'm sure many people can identify with this concept in general. I like to say that I was good at school, but I was a terrible student. I got that scholarship, which is defined as a minority scholarship because of my status as an Appalachian, at least at the time. I don't know if this is still true. Ohio State categorized Appalachian as a minority population because of our economic situation in general down here. Mm-hmm. So As someone who was doing fairly well in school, lots of people were like, you should do a science thing, given the limited range of experience that most people have down here. That was pretty much, you should become an engineer. I didn't have any kind of strong inkling toward that, but I was fairly good at math and science. So I said, sure, why not? Mm-hmm. I got into the honors engineering program at Ohio State and quickly found out that my capabilities of like studying difficult material, mm-hmm. lack of capabilities in that regard, and a general lack of motivation sort of caught up with me. So, yeah, I lost that scholarship, and I was facing academic probation actually in it as far as the engineering school was concerned. Mm-hmm. And I talked to my advisor, and she recommended that I try out this GIS thing. Mm-hmm. I wrote this down because it was something about mapping fire hydrants is all she could really describe, or I remember describing it.
Yeah, that's all there is to it. GIS, just fire hydrants, mapping them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, little did I know, I would spend a lot of time mapping fire hydrants. But I was like, sure, why not? I really had no idea what I wanted to do. And she was like, this will use some of the classes you've already taken, so you won't be starting over. I remember walking into a cartography class, which frankly I didn't realize still had to be taught because I didn't know people made maps. The icebreaker was one of the questions on it. We all had to write on index card, why are you taking this class? And I was like, be brutally honest here, I'm taking this class because I'm thinking about changing my major and this is a required course. pretty quickly I realized that I like this. So part of the problem with a straight science field for me was I always tend to be kind of a creative person, and I did not feel the capability to do that in like engineering. My freshman engineering project in the honors program when I was there, I assume they still do this. We built a robot. Our robot was most innovative. Like, that's the kind of brainwave we're on. Mm-hmm. So I got into this thing where it was like a decent amount of science, but like you also had to do this art thing and make things that like people could read or wanted to look at and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so that clicked with me. And then like, let's just be perfectly honest, I also found the technical aspects of it a lot easier, and they played into some of the lack of strength I have in ability to study and be motivated in that regard. So it was a perfect marriage there. The next problem was, you know, like, how do you find a job in this, right?
Yeah, that's definitely a wall that I've come up against, and a lot of the kids I'm sort of graduating in the coming spring, like a lot of folks just go to job boards and type in GIS, like that's going to do something. And I've already learned that's not a great way to go about it. So I'm curious how that went for you.
So my understanding is that I was in the relative infancy of GIS at Ohio State. Like, that's mm-hmm. what I've come to realize understand in recent years. So when I was talking to my new advisor in the geography program, and I was like, I probably need to get some kind of internship or something, man. And he was like, cool. Yeah. I was like, what should I do? And he's like, I don't know, maybe call up like county engineers or something. You know, little did I know the wealth of GIS activity that was happening in Columbus blocks away. Somewhat ironically, have worked more with Morpsey there in Columbus since I've started my professional career than I ever even knew that they existed as a student. So it was it's a little bit frustrating, but literally I called up the county engineer for here in Washington County and said, I'm a GIS student. Are there GIS things that you need doing? Because I would like to do an independent study project. He said, much to my surprise, yeah, we've got a guy that does our GIS. Here's his cell phone. Hmm. So I called this guy up, and he says to me, yeah, I got something you can do. If you can live here and you have a car.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, My room's still open, so yeah. And I've got one of those cars, so yeah. And after two phone calls, I had an internship.
Well, that was easy.
I remember meeting my soon-to-be supervisor for the first time in person, and he goes, I'm gonna need like a resume to have on file for you." I was like, "Oh, I better go write one of those." So yeah, I'm hopeless at trying to get people to jobs in the current job market. I'm hopeless at the current job market. Suddenly I'm data collecting and I'm doing projects, and I did that for the summer, and there the grant that was funding that ended, and I had graduated, so I was like, "Well, off into the wild blue yonder, right? Let's go get ourselves one of them jobs." This was in 2009, so you can probably imagine how fun that was even
Yeah,
then.
definitely a lot of anxiety, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I probably was just blocking most of that out. So I called this fellow back up and said, "Man, you're local. You have a license of ArcMap. I need to keep doing this stuff. Can I come out and work like 4 hours a week and just do stuff?" I'm not sure how long I did that volunteering thing. It wasn't very long before they came over to me and said, "Do you want to get paid for this?" I was like,
Yes, I would. Thank you very much. $1, please.
whatever. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then after a little while of that, this guy, my supervisor, takes me out to lunch, and he's like, "So, I'm thinking about taking the director job here that's open. Would you like to work full time?" And then he says, and I'll never forget this, because he then like stops and goes, "Now, I'm not this, you like you don't have to be like beholden to us. Like, you can still leave if you want. Like, you're not under any kind of contract or anything." But and I was like, "Man, you had me at full-time job. I don't have one
Yeah, like
of
there was no question after that. Yes, I would like one employment.
those." Yeah, precisely. "Oh, I get to stop working retail? Awesome. I get to do this full time and have an office? What?" And so yeah, so that was how I started my career at Buckeye Hills. I remember that they waived my probationary period because I'd already been there for a year part time before I started full time. And then a little while back, we actually added another GIS person, and I sort of was informally supervising them. And so that's when I got bumped up to the fancy coordinator title. Yes. Yes, exactly. It feels a lot more fancy than it actually is in practice, that's for sure.
'Cause I've shared on the show that I'm now an intern for MORPC, Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, which is similar but different. You know, we have quite a lot of people we service, and the needs of our organization are same but different than probably what your organization does. So talk to me sort of about like the general activities that Buckeye Hills does, and then talk to me about how GIS fits into that.
So we kind of have two primary arms at Buckeye Hills. Again, Buckeye Hills is this regional council, council of governments, however you want to call it. A local development district is another thing that we get called. And the basic idea is that we fill in where a community doesn't have staff, not like in a temporary position, but in like sort of a contract basis. I'll go into more detail on that in a second, because we also had this other arm. We're relatively unique in Ohio that we're also a area agency on aging, as well as a local development district. And that's actually where most of our staff is in our aging sector. And so I serve in the development department primarily. I mean, that's my direct supervisor is our development director. And that's where most of my work goes. So internally, I am supporting all those other positions. So when we're helping somebody write a grant and they need a location map, I make that. When we are writing our comprehensive economic development strategy for the Economic Development Administration, I'm helping produce data for that, right? I'm gathering the data. Sometimes it's spatial, sometimes it's just general demographic tabular data, but I'm putting that stuff together. More recently, we have started doing transportation planning as well. We were a pilot program for the Ohio Department of Transportation's Regional Transportation Planning Organization Initiative back in 2013. Mm-hmm. We were officially recognized as such by the governor in 2015. That is where a significant amount of my time goes. A large part of my job has become part of this transportation planning thing. You might recognize that transportation planning was not explicitly part of anything I learned in school. I didn't know any of that before I jumped into this. Suddenly now I'm a transportation planner. I actually had a recent experience in a school. I was brought in to kind of talk to them about what I do and introduce a problem that I experience in my professional capacity and try to get them to think about how to solve that problem. I was giving the presentation that I gave about what GIS is and how it's used at Buckeye Hills. And part of that was in regard to transportation. And one of the students pops up and says, what is it about these roundabouts? Why does everybody want to install these? Teacher goes, now, that's not what he does. He makes the maps. And I was like, well, actually, I do know about roundabouts. Hold on. Where's the dry erase marker? Let me explain conflict points and why a roundabout is inherently safer than a four-way intersection.
And how old were these students?
These were high school students.
Okay, yeah, it's time you learn about conflict points. It's time you learn about an effective and efficient road network.
Yeah, I try to keep the conflict points out of the talks I give to third graders, although I do believe I said that to a third grade class. I think that it requires action from both directions, though, right? And I think that there are a lot of call them business entities. I mean, that includes even like the governmental adjacent ones that just don't put a lot of stock into working with schools. And I don't really understand it. So we have a friendship here. We're formerly located in Marietta, Ohio. You might know it as the gateway to the Northwest Territory, the first settlement here, older than the state of Ohio itself by far, home to more see if I can say this correctly. It's like the greatest collection of Revolutionary War officers, like outside of the 13th colonies, buried here. Like super old. We got a college. It's fairly prominent, and they have a history professor there that is really interested in what GIS can do and has got a program going. Because he's motivated and because we're motivated, like we've been working with him to do cool stuff. So I'm going to go to the sort of the last thing that you talked about, because it's one of my favorite projects, and maybe it'll branch off into other things. Like we were at a conference, and we saw that this city had done they worked with a consultant to do a parking inventory and analysis. And the results were interesting, just the amount of space in their city covered by parking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And my supervisor looks at this. When I go to conferences with him and there's a show and tell sort of thing, I just tag along because he's going to find something and I'm going to have to do it, right? So yep. It's like I could be networking. It might look like I'm trying to avoid contact with people, but it's more that I need to know what I'm going to be expected to do when we get back to the office. And so we see this thing and he's like, we're gonna do this. And he contacts this professor at Marietta College, and we actually got the students to do the work. We present, we build a database for them, explain to them what the process was going to be, and handed it off and let them do it. And so they got relatively real world experience. I mean, it is very basic, photo interpretation, data creation, stuff, but it had a real tangible benefit. We went and presented it to the city council and stuff like that. And we found out that in the core downtown area, the area they identified as their revitalization district, they had 3,000 parking spaces. Now, most of those were private, but there's only 15,000 people in the entire city.
Something's hinky.
Yeah, explain to me how that math works out, right? And then I took it and I did some other sort of overlay analyses. Like, there's a local mall and I digitized the local mall and its parking lot and overlaid it onto the city and showed that, like, if you parked at this parking lot and went to this store on this street, it would be the same as parking at this point in the mall and walking the length of the mall. Like, it's no different. It's what people do all the time. And they talked about that in the newspaper and whatnot. And that's still getting brought up, right? Because, like, people are still saying things like, oh, we don't have enough parking, or if we do this project, we'll lose all this parking. And it's like, look at what we have. We have so much. Like, getting the in with a school like that, like, we're still trying to find, that was kind of a perfect project because it was relatively easy for the students to do. They could actually go out and feel verify this stuff because we had to mark whether it was private private or city or county or federal and stuff like that. And so I know it was like part of their assignment. They had to go down and actually look at the site and stuff like that. And so we've been trying to find more local projects that are that sort of data collection-y things. And that hasn't been as easy as this project was. But the amount of, like, I've got copies of this map that I made for it printed off in my desk. And, like, it's multiple times a year that I pull that out and, like, show it to somebody and say, like, this is going on. And we've made it like a regular part of our deliverables. So, like, we've started working with communities. We've got these villages. They have populations in the hundreds. Like, we're talking incredibly small. In some cases, they have trouble, like, even, like, filling all their elected positions that they're required to have. And nobody there, through mostly no fault of their own, is, like, really thinking about the future and making, like, a plan for where they want their community to go, right? And so we're trying to sort of develop a baseline thing that we can take to them and walk them through a rudimentary planning process. We don't call it a plan because plans kind of involve more public involvement, but it is sort of like a list of priorities. And part of that is for them to sort of establish what they already know about their community, or maybe don't know and need to know about it. And that parking analysis, because I can whip it out for some of these small places in an afternoon, it has become a regular part of that information dump, right?
So that kind of makes me, I'm trying to kind of pivot back. I feel like we've got off topic, and now this is kind of bringing us back to a couple of the questions that I sent you for our notes. So this, like, community response to the GIS projects that you guys do, in school, you know, city and regional planning, and through my work at ODOT and now MORPC, you know, I've gotten exposure to a lot of urban problems. And if there's one thing about folks that live in cities, either you don't care about the plans or you care way too much about the plans. What is it? You know, citizens against virtually everything. People. You know, we get a lot of those. And I feel like the GIS work I've done anyway, like, it's, I feel like it doesn't have as profound of an effect because I feel like all the work we do is very saturated, and I feel like there's a map product for everything, and now everyone's doing web maps and story maps. Everyone's getting hip to, like, the maps you got on your phone, and I sound like an old person, like, the maps you got on your phone. You know, in, you know, these planning classes, we learn, you know, that, you know, urban problems and rural problems may overlap, may be similar, but, you know, urban solutions can't be applied to rural problems. And so, like, the GIS and how we use it in urban spaces may be same but different, maybe radically different from how we use it in rural settings. And so, I guess, let me figure out how to make this an actual question. Like, how significant a difference do you feel it is, like, using GIS for, like, an urban versus the rural population you serve? And how, if you have noticed, how do you think the community responds differently than, like, an urban community might?
So I think you've got, like, the same groups of people that you just described. You've got the people that they care way too much and the people that care too little. I think the care too little is has a bigger impact on the rural community. Mm-hmm. Because when you have so few people to start off with, if too many of them are just uninterested, mm-hmm. Then it's really hard to see like any kind of change, you know, good or bad sometimes.
Yeah.
I will say that in general, like adoption is or acceptance to GIS is confusing down here. well, because you got people that get it, right? And they mm-hmm. really get it. And like, I can't believe in the time that I've been doing this, how much has changed. And frankly, how much more achievable it is on a budget than it was when I started.
Hmm.
We've got a county that has about 14,000 people in the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on ArcGIS Online. Their property data is on there. They've flown aerial photos
mm-hmm.
using their money, and that's on there. Now, I had to help them put it on there because their internet literally wasn't good enough to upload the data.
Oh, like, man.
Like, they just couldn't sustain the connection. And so they literally mm-hmm. mailed me a hard drive and sent me their credentials and said, like, please put this online for us. Even the people that get it sometimes are hampered by the literal physical conditions under which that they live, right?
Yeah.
And then, thankfully, like you're talking about, like maps on your phone, like that's actually been a tremendous advantage to us because
mm-hmm.
It used to be that you were locked behind this absurdly expensive equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we started data collection, I was using a $10,000 GPS unit that plus including the software, and like I can't expect a water system that has 500 customers to pay that for like their own GPS unit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with the changes we have now, I can get it on their phone for next to nothing, right? Like for a few hundred dollars, they can access their entire system on their phone, make edits and changes. And I'm clear to them that if they use the phone to make spatial changes, it's not going to be mm-hmm. the same quality as my multiple thousand dollar unit is.
Mm-hmm.
But with an aerial photo, you can get pretty close to right. And as long as all you're changing is the attributes, like, or if you're just comfortable with whatever the data accuracy is, like, I'm not going to throw shade at you because it's not down to a foot accuracy. If it gets you mm-hmm. there, it gets you there. I don't care, whatever works. So we got some of that. It's gotten a little bit better, a little bit, but there's still a significant issue with, in particular, water systems where there's a guy that knows everything
mm-hmm.
and he views that as his job security. And he views me coming mm-hmm. in with my GPS unit as a way to get him fired. Right. Like I've had mm-hmm. people tell me that straight to my face. You're here so they can fire me.
Hmm.
And I mean, gosh, how am I supposed to respond to that? It's like that's
yeah.
I'm not here to do that. I'm here so that when you choose to leave, this system isn't completely out of like up the creek without the paddle. Right. Like
yeah.
I want to make sure that the information you have is captured and like. Because, yeah, I guess they could fire you. You could also get hit by a bus tomorrow and they've got nothing. Like,
mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that they have something. And I mean, most of those people aren't in position to really fight against it. So they help us get the data. But it's concerning to me because I don't want people to feel like I'm there so that they can lose their job. Like, that's not what yeah. I'm here for. But enough people, I think, get it. Now, there is a problem with sort of like continued use. Like we'll collect this data and then like that'll be the end of it. We try to explain to them like, no, this is like once we do this, it's old. Like you need to keep it up. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm going back through now and trying to recontact all those people and get them onto a platform that hopefully allows them to engage more directly with the data. You know,
mm-hmm.
When we started this, we were operating our own server, literally on a piece of equipment in our office. We're using the cheapest version of ArcGIS server, getting it to allow you to edit data is an absolute nightmare. I didn't want to manage the different people that would have access to edit the data, right? Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't a thing. And I'm concerned that not allowing them to manipulate their own data further sort of disenfranchise them. So we're working to kind of go back with those people and say, hey, we have this information. Like, this is the new setup. I think it actually worked out to be cheaper for you, and you get to maintain it. You get access on your phone, on the web, and all that stuff. And that it, so for the governments, it's a crapshoot. Like, locally, there's like a system that people have that's like super old, where it's a GIS, it's a real GIS, and all the data is copied on everybody's computers. But like, it's clunky to use, and it's super clunky for me to update. But it's there, and they really like it, and so that's good. A lot of people, sort of under our noses, are working with consultants, spending what I think sometimes is way too much to get systems that we could help them provide themselves. But they're adopting it, and I'm excited about that, right? Like, they are concerned about sort of their asset management and stuff like that. I think that there's been pushes at the EPA, the state EPA level, to sort of force in particular water systems to consider this stuff. So they're doing it, and they're thinking about it. And when we come in and explain what we can provide, they're interested, right? Mm-hmm. On sort of a more local level, or like the person level, mm-hmm. it's actually been a lot better, right? So a big problem is I don't know how they're supposed to know this. People don't know what the capabilities of GIS are, right? Like, the easiest way to say it is maps on computer, but then they just think that like you're literally just taking Atlas maps and like digitizing them. Like, it's like we were working with a group that was called together out of an opioid issue, and it morphed into, how do we get people who have transportation issues to jobs? Because as in a rural community, traditional, tract, I forget what the word I'm looking for is, but like traditional transit, you know, fixed route, that's what I'm looking for. Fixed route transit doesn't work except in very small doses, right? And when you got people that are spread out all over the hinterlands, how do you get people that don't have good transportation options to work, right? Mm-hmm. And so I got brought into this meeting because people were talking about information, and my coworkers were in there, and they understand it. So they're like, you need to be here and talk to these people about this. And I was able to pull down data from some of the census products that exist and make a map of the county at the tract level, because that's the best I could do. And it's an interactive dashboard using the new stuff that Esri's got. So it has the map of the county. It has like two tables that show you, one is a breakdown of the number of people in households that only have zero or one car. So it's like, what percentage of them are one person, two people, three people, and then four plus. And then the other one is households with one or more person, or like more than one person, and that have zero or one cars, right? And because it's all interactive, you can like click on a problem area, and that highlights it geographically. Because like, I started making this thing, and I was like, this is going to be like 18 maps. They're not going to understand any of it, right? If I make these tables, they're going to ask me, well, which one census tract 212? I don't know, right? Like, so making this thing that allows them to like click on a thing and instantly isolate the area, right, and know exactly what they're looking at. And then I was also able to pull in, it's a very confusing thing to say, but the census has the number of people who work in an area who come from households with some number of vehicles, right? So they might not live, but they're in, like, we can combine all this information, you can see it immediately. The whole thing's set up, so if you click on one, it isolates the other stuff. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's all whiz-bang, but like it actually tells them the information that they need to know, right?
Yeah.
And like I showed that and that just blew their mind. And I knew immediately that I screwed up only doing one county because I need to do all eight of our counties like this now.
Yeah. Yeah.
and so that kind of stuff that gets people, right? Mm-hmm. You see a lot more appreciation for it. The problem is just the burden of getting them to know what the options are. Like so many times I'm brought into a meeting and they're just like, what can you do for us? And I'm like, mm-hmm. it doesn't work that way. You need to show me what you're doing and what your problems are. And I mm-hmm. will see how I can use spatial information to solve those problems. Right.
Yeah.
So let's do another example here that it's more in our agency. Right. So, mm-hmm. Because I'm under this development wing, I don't work as closely as I might prefer with our aging entities. Mm-hmm. We have like a long-term project with them, but not the way we really want to. And mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how this came up, but they came to me and my colleague and said, like, we're having issues redistributing our caseload. So we've got these like 20-ish case managers. We've got like 900 clients. We need mm-hmm. to distribute these so they're fairly even, and ideally we'd like the burden of travel to be as low as possible. Mm-hmm. My guy and I were instantly like, oh, like we can solve this easily with maps, like mm-hmm. this is a straightforward issue that you're having. So mm-hmm. like we mapped those clients, we mapped our case managers, we made drive time rings around the case managers. We just join those two things together. Now, they don't see any of that map, right? We give them a spreadsheet that says it has like a client name, like duplicated a bunch of times to say like they're within 15 minutes of this case manager, 30 minutes of this guy, 45 minutes here, 60 minutes mm-hmm. here. And they can just go down that list and apply to the closest one until that person's roster gets full up. And then they just start applying to the next closest one. Mm-hmm. They did this thing used to take them like a week to do with like post-it notes and stuff. Like, I don't even know how they pulled it off. And you're talking about people like the money saved has been, I think, staggering. It's hard to quantify, but like you've got highly paid like director positions mm-hmm. that are spending all this time doing it. The mental anguish on them was terrible because they were they dreaded it every time they had to do it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
We prepare the data in an afternoon and it takes them the next morning to finish it. Like it's hours out of days. Mm-hmm. And getting them to understand that part of it, right? They're like, just talk to me about what it is you're trying to accomplish and let me see if there is a way that I can solve it with the tools that I have.
Yeah, the communication barrier there is really difficult because I think like in the work that I've been able to do and in the city, I feel generally as an assumption, people are more tech literate. And so if you like, oh, I do spatial data analytics, probably like 7 out of 10 are like on board and they're like, yeah, I get that. And then there's 3 that might need like a little explanation. And I feel like for a rural population that is maybe less tech literate, I can imagine it must be really difficult. And, the example you shared of like having that knowledge, I guess, like remote knowledge, like you know where all of the whatever piece of infrastructure is, you know where all the culverts are. Mm-hmm. But if you knock out tomorrow, we're gonna have to get that information at some point. So kind of what you're talking about, like you did that map data work behind the scenes of creating like the drive sheds and joining mm-hmm. features and layers, and then you know you didn't hand them a map, you didn't hand mm-hmm. them the arc map file and say, there you go. You had to put it back into a spreadsheet and make it like once again a consumable format, which is interesting.
So yeah, there's another example of that. The Ohio Department of Taxation requires that every county that has horizontal wells, maybe more colloquially known as frack wells, they mm-hmm. have to distribute the tax revenue from those wells based off of where the product is actually drawn. So these lines can be thousands of feet long and they can they can cross jurisdictional boundaries. And okay. In regards to counties, it's like other county lines and what are called like taxing districts. Mm-hmm. One of our counties who had worked with us pretty heavily and knew what we were capable of, like just laid it out in front of us and said, tell us if you can solve this problem. I know you can. And tell us how mm-hmm. much it's going to cost. Like, mm-hmm. just solve it for us. As another one of those where, like, there's a ton of map in between. But it starts as a spreadsheet and it ends as a spreadsheet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a relatively complicated set of actions that has to go through that. We actually presented on this topic at a workshop at OhioGS a couple years ago mm-hmm. because we formulated it in such a way you can do it with the most basic level of ArcMap. And while if you don't have very, very little or no GS experience, it's going to be hard. I think it's doable by literally anybody. And I mm-hmm. would like to see more counties sort of literally do it themselves if they're mm-hmm. willing to. We'll train them on how to do it, give them a very detailed document that explains the process of it. But it took us a long time to wear that down. I mean, the amount of like, oh, we ran this tool and we didn't realize it. When you run this tool, it just wipes out the entire attribute table. So we have to make sure that we have a copy ready to rejoin it back in, or when we did mm-hmm. this, we lost this piece of information, or when we're done, we need to be able to grab this piece of information. So there's all these like complicated joins that go in so that you can make sure you grab data that's going to disappear when you do this other thing. And, it's ugly, but again, yeah, it's a table at the end. And this is something that like, I keep trying, like I put into the talks that I give to students, which is like, it's not all about making maps to help these people. Now I want to go back to the guy that knows everything, because there's a nicer way that we use when we're giving proposals to people to start mapping their own data. Mm-hmm. We don't want to talk about the guy dying, right? So instead we say, because this was the original impetus for this project, was this guy wanted to retire, actually. And he wanted to go fly fishing out in Montana and didn't want nobody calling him about where certain water valves were or something like mm-hmm. that, right? So we came in to grab that information out of his head. And that's what we tell people. It's like, you know, we're here to save you, right? Like to come in and just get the information out of your head onto something that you can use. I just gave a presentation to a small local public water system that we had been collecting their data. And we want to enter in a more long-term contract with them to host their data online and allow them to manipulate it and whatnot. And I mean, I'm getting asked some pretty serious questions. Most of them are pretty good. I mean, they're saying like, you know, who owns this information when you do this? Well, you own it. We just house it, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So like, I think that some of these people ask the right things. The biggest problem, especially when you start talking about planning, especially what that word means, right? Planning, mm-hmm. like actually considering the future. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways, I don't know if I'd really say it's a dirty word around here. It's definitely not a strong concern. I think because we've had a significant number of efforts that have just sort of ended up on the shelves, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when it comes to our people, we're really hesitant to call a lot of things plans, because we think that gives a grander nature to it. Like mm-hmm. the plan will come. What we want you to do is just stop and think about what your priorities are, what you want to see happen. Get those down on mm-hmm. a piece of paper. So as my supervisor said recently, so when the citizen comes to you and says that he wants to divert public funds to a UFO detection system, you can explain to him that, no, like we as your elected officials have sat down and decided that our priority is enhancing water service here, or solving this this wastewater issue or this mm-hmm. flooding issue. But we'll take what you say into consideration, right? Like mm-hmm. if you don't have a plan, then when the guy comes to you asking for the UFO thing, you just kind of got to flounder around and be like, mm-hmm. oh, we don't want to do that. But if you can say, we've sat down, we've thought about it. And the way that, you know, GIS can help with that is by One, hopefully confirming some things. The other side is sort of dispelling truths or identifying holes.
Hey guys, it's Emmy. Just taking a quick break. We're at the halfway point for the episode, so stay with us. But I wanted to do quick shout-outs and thank you, Rosie Ross, for the use of our theme song, Feeling Fool. A link to that can be found in the description. And most of the stuff that Jason and I talk about this episode, about Buckeye Hills, AVs, etc., there will also be links included in the description. So look for those if you'd like to follow up any further on any of our discussions. And thank you again, Jason, for joining me for this episode. You're absolutely great. And I won't keep you any longer. We're going to go back to the episode.
In especially, I think this, I feel like it's probably is a little bit worse at the rural level. It's the real garbage in, garbage out kind of situation, right? If we aren't being fed the right amount of the right information, we can't quantify the experiences of our citizens, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of our planning efforts, honestly, are just demonstrating to people what data exists, so that they can react to it, and then informing them that if that is not in line with their perception, that they need to figure out sort of what that disconnect is, right? Is it that people aren't submitting information the way they should be? Is it that they're like literally avoiding it? I mean, I know that there's a lot of people out there on those, you know, dark township roads that if they crash into a ditch, they're calling their friend, not the police, right? And so we're not going to have any record of that, right? And if we don't have record of it, then we're going to have a hard time going for funding to fix your problematic road, right?
You know, we've shared emails about like your position and the work you do, but just hearing you describe it verbally and, you know, describing these handful of projects and the care and attention you put into creating products that will be utilized by the community in a significant way, and acknowledging, I mean, you do everything. You do GIS top to bottom, and I think that is really fun and really rare.
I mean, thank goodness we got two of us now. It's actually really interesting. That guy has been really interested in sort of the more high-tech coding aspect of it. But I seem to be a little bit better at reading and interpreting the code. So, like, he'll write stuff and be like, why doesn't this work? And then I'll come over and read it and be like, well, that's because you're doing this thing, man. You need to, like, switch this around and then leave. But, yeah, like, and that's because so we have the freedom for him to be like, oh, I want to figure out how to automate this process. So, like, we're down here in Appalachia. We're just south of Ohio's big shale boom. We interact with it a little bit. It was a concern of our board members to just be aware of like what's happening with that. So for years, we've been going to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources page on shale wells, and they have a couple spreadsheets that talk about the Utica and Marcellus shales, and they have all the wells mapped on there and their status and whatnot. And we've been going through there every single month for years and downloading those, right? And this guy finally goes like, I want to automate this. So we let him at it, and like, I'm not entire, like, it's not done, right? But like, it works, and now we don't have to worry about it, right? And the next project is as we start hosting this data for our communities and they start editing their data without our involvement, we want to be able to apply sort of that same thought process to their data, downloading it sequentially, keeping multiple backups so that when somebody makes a boo-boo and like deletes the entire water network and that gets saved, and they did it 4 days ago and we've already run the update, they don't got to go back to that first data set and recapture it, right?
Yeah.
Until that happens, we're going to have to do that manually. We're happy to do that, but we would love to be able to automate that. So guy gets to do that, right? And thankfully it's not the only thing that he has to do. So when he runs into a roadblock and just can't handle it anymore, he can go make a map for somebody, handle some simple data request, stuff like that. We're also surprised by the number of things that we do that are sort of like data requests that we handle those for people, anybody, private citizens, company, like businesses, And like other governments and stuff like that, if there's information that's publicly available and your data request is relatively simple, as we say, like if we can do it in about a day or less, like we just do it, right? And we had somebody call us a couple years ago and ask us about aging, population 65 and over and in poverty, and using like waivers for their living expenses. And we found this information. We made like this 3-part map that has the county 3 times over and shows us information in different ways. And I've always liked the sort of look of it. And I get into a meeting literally yesterday, and they're like, this guy's calling us about this in this county. And I'm like, I think we have something that's exactly it, the information you need to talk to this guy about. Hold on, like let me grab this thing and show it to you. And he looked at it and was like, yes, this is exactly what I need to be able to talk to him. And I'm like, oh great, like that was work I didn't have to do because we did it 2 years ago. Like so being able to help people like that, I mean, it's why I'm still here, right? Like we can talk all day about general compensation for people, especially in rural areas, and then you talk about compensation for sort of like public employees, right? Like I could go somewhere else and possibly make twice what I'm making now, but would I enjoy it? I don't know. Like I like this. I like being able to actually see the results of what I do. I like being able to follow a project from beginning to end. I don't think I would enjoy it if I just made the data and shipped it off to somebody to do something with, right? And it's fun doing cool stuff too, right? Like we like the people that the GIS people that work for the counties, they rely on us to be sort of on the leading edge of everything. And they know that they can contact us and say, hey, I'm trying to accomplish this thing. You know how to do it. How can I do this, or something along those lines? And we've helped a lot of people like that, people that are trying to use some of the data collection apps that exist now, setting things up properly and stuff like that. And we just come out and do it. And like my feeling is that if the more capacity that I can build into our member like communities, the more cool, fun stuff I get to spend my time doing, right? Like, I don't want to make you maps that's just like, where are the census tracts? Or I don't want to tell you just like what the median household income is. Like, you can learn how to get that kind of information, or you can hire people whose sort of job is primarily to help you as a community get that kind of information, especially when it comes to the county level. I feel like even our smallest counties, and all of them do now, have GIS people in some capacity. You know, some are more limited in what they can do, but I'm pretty sure that every county has somebody that's using GIS software to make data. And that's just a huge weight off my back because it means I don't have to like individually manage your data, right? I get to be there to help you when you're reaching beyond maybe what your skill sets are or what your training was or what your daily activities are. Build that into you and then go off. Like we actually handled a project regarding agricultural land use that the county was doing, and they contract with us to do that for years, and they finally hired somebody that had GS experience, and I was like, this will be so much better if he can do this in-house. And so I trained him on how to do it. I think last year was the first year that he like fully did it himself. And I don't care that we sort of lost that contract money. It doesn't really matter to me. He knows now that, you know, I mean, not that he didn't know before, but like definitely knows now that if he needs something like that, something he can't do, like we're the people to talk to, right? and we give ownership back to them. We're not there to like soak up their money just because they're there, right? I
Yeah.
want to improve their capacity because I can always learn something new and exciting and bring that back. So that's my thing here. Yeah, I want to build as much capacity as is reasonable to ask for these communities to do. That's probably what my goal is.
Yeah, that's a good goal. And I think that kind of, I think, let's see, we've got like an hour 15 of audio. So let's wrap it up on this one.
Sure.
So kind
I can
of,
talk about this stuff forever. I mean, honestly, like especially to be able to talk about it to somebody where I'm not explaining the basics of what's going on, right? Like just trying to
right.
explain what the thing is and being able to talk about it like holistically or theoretically is frankly exciting.
Yeah,
So
it's fun. We'll probably have to have you on for a part two because we haven't even scratched the surface of rural planning and what even is GIS, and I
no.
could probably devote an entire show specifically to like how we can use GIS. But let's wrap up with this question. So you've talked about sort of a little bit like what your vision is for like the future of like your agency, your region using GIS. And in Columbus, we are having a lot of hot gossip about things on the horizon in transportation and planning processes. I attended a summit earlier this week called Think Beyond that had to do with the title of the day of events was like Urban Universities and Thriving Communities. There were several speakers and panel sessions that happened, and everyone was talking about like sustainability and what sort of activities we're looking forward to, as cities continue to grow, as rural populations continue to grow, as our resources get more and more strained. And sort of like the key challenges that were brought up was like, we're going to have more and more people, and all of those people are going to need to move around. And a bunch of people wanted to talk about AVs as like one potential challenge. An AV is still a car. You're not solving cars with AVs, you're just adding more cars. So that's one, big like urban problem on the horizon. What do you anticipate, or maybe I'm sure you've thought about this, we talk about this a lot. What do you kind of anticipate the next big challenge in like rural planning might be?
It's the same thing. So literally, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm to talk to you, I actually skipped a summit on driverless cars. It was hosted by my organization today. The future of smart mobility in southeastern Ohio is what I did not go to. I've got very complicated feelings about even specifically things like driverless cars. What I'm trying to get our transportation planning efforts to be focused on more is this idea of kind of accessibility rather than mobility. Getting as many different people to be able to get where they need to go rather than just facilitate general movement. Like, think more specifically about how are these kinds of populations going to get where they need to get to. In an somewhat ideal scenario, I think that things like driverless vehicles can help us with that. The question is, how are they going to navigate our rural infrastructure? Which is why I'm glad that, we're having conversations like, how does autonomous and connected vehicles work in a rural setting? How do connected vehicles work if you don't have a connection, right? How do autonomous vehicles work if you don't have road lines? The terrifying number of roads don't have, I mean, like they're barely even one lane in some cases, let alone have proper marking and whatnot. I think that that is eminently solvable by technology. You make a good point, and it's something that, like, say, like, yeah, driverless cars don't solve the car problem if congestion is an issue, right? As I said before, we don't have a congestion issue, and I think that in some ways, autonomous vehicles can really help solve a lot of our problems, because we have, in general, even in these rural areas, spread out from the cities. Mm-hmm. And we've got a lot of elderly people living way out. Yeah. Down in our area, several of our counties have actually pretty solid on-demand transit programs. Now, is a significant issue communicating that those programs exist to the mm-hmm. people. And yeah. that's kind of where a lot of our efforts in the very near future here are moving. But like, I can foresee a future where that becomes a lot easier to manage, right? If autonomous vehicles reach a certain state where you've got autonomous transit systems and stuff like that, so that you don't have to employ people. You can run those vehicles more hours. Demand isn't as big of a meeting demand isn't as big of an issue and stuff like that. But just getting people to understand what options are available is what our near mm-hmm. future is. I don't think people realize what they can do. In our town here, Marietta, we actually have a certain amount of fixed route transit. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think people realize what it like, one, how relatively inexpensive it is, how relatively accommodating they'll be, mm-hmm. like stopping where they don't have designated stops and even deviating from the line to pick up people if necessary, as long mm-hmm. as you've arranged that ahead of time. So much so that we actually recently had a small community group just ride the bus to understand if it's actually meeting their needs. Like a small group of people got together, and because like we were saying this in our office, I was saying like we need to get people on the bus to see if it does what they need to do. And like the next day there was an article in the paper saying, oh, this group rode the bus to just get an idea of like whether it was realistic to use it or not. And so like that, I think, is that's our near term future, is just getting people to understand what transportation options currently exist down here. Like, I keep talking about Marietta. It's where I live. It's the thing I see the most. We've recently done an extension out of a bike trail. So now you can bike from town all the way out to where my office is. Now you have to do it on a sidewalk after you get past a certain section, but you don't want to be biking on that road. And no one walks on the sidewalk because it's inhospitable to pedestrians. But the point is you can. And so getting more people to sort of realize what their realistic options are, and also working with those transit agencies to bend a little bit to meet what's necessary, right? That's mm-hmm. that's the near-term connection. I would like to see things like autonomous vehicles solve problems. You know, I'm growing increasingly concerned that they won't, but I am really glad that somebody is thinking about the unique issues that autonomous vehicles will encounter in rural areas and really thinking about how we can mitigate those, so that if we do see advantages of them, they can be enjoyed by people down here and not just that thing you get to experience when you go up to the city. Right. Yeah. You know, at this moment, for most people, owning or having access to a car is the ante to be able to just experience life.
Yeah.
And anything we can do to reduce that requirement, I think, will be a benefit. Mm-hmm. How we convince people that that is an option is something
that's a whole other beast. Yeah. A cultural revolution.
I might be careful using that exact terminology, but yes, yeah, it is definitely asking for people to seriously rethink how they've been operating, right, and what their true options are. So, yeah, that's what I want to do, is just bring more creativity and more questions, right? I want more people to ask, why can't we do that? And have people in my position explain why they can't, have to justify why something is happening. And I'm perfectly happy to justify most of the things that we propose, right? And it's not just because we think that it'll bring more economic development or not, but like there's evidence that these changes have positive outcomes. And if reducing how much people are required to drive a car, I think will have a direct positive impact. I'm not trying to take your car away. I'm just making it so I want to make it so that if you don't have one, you're not completely out of luck. That's what I would like to see.
And yeah, taking away that exclusionary element of car ownership and just the different level of privilege that you are enabled by having a vehicle in this modern day and age in America.
Yeah, I mean, like, goodness, is it even right in some cases to call it like privilege? It's like it's a requirement, right? I mean, obviously it's a privilege, but like, wow, how many privileges are required to just function? I mean,
yeah.
And around here, you don't have a car. I mean, now I also around here, I don't know exactly what this is like in the urban areas, but around here, people are highly skeptical of self-driving cars.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a good mix of folks. I mean, we had Smart Columbus debuted their first pilot downtown, and it was very like a tourist type attraction thing, and it had a very good reception. And actually next week they're debuting like a first mile, last mile connector over in the Linden neighborhood. So it's going to be a very different context for the route. It's going to connect several community centers and connect to like the transit hub over in Linden off of, I want to say 5th, but I could be wrong. So it's going to be like trying to solve some issues, whereas, you know, the first pilot was just getting people like familiar with this new machine on the roads. But it's also, you know, the allure of this one that was downtown for a while was like it was near Kosai, it was near like Brewery and Arena District, where people are, you know, out wandering around doing fun things on an afternoon. So it was like these people weren't there to ride the shuttle because they needed to get somewhere. It was an attraction. But the case in Linden will be that this will be attempting to solve mobility issues. And it's a different crowd, a different audience. And so, you know, we've yet to see, I'm going to be actually part of a research team that's going to do like focus groups and administering surveys of the shuttle users once the Linden project debuts. It's going to be really interesting to see. I was kind of critical of the loop that happened downtown. I was just like, it doesn't go anywhere. It goes around the river and like, ugh. And I did ride it and it was fun. but it felt like we were bragging about the $40 million grant we got. And now seeing the Linden shuttle happen, it's like, oh, you know, now we are demonstrating the use and implementing it in one of the communities that probably needs it most in Columbus. So
use the attraction to get people comfortable with the concept. Now we're doing the real test case to see if it actually helps people move around. Yeah. I am both excited and horrifically terrified by them. I am very excited by the concept of like, oh, when I have to go to Columbus, I could just like take a nap. That sounds fantastic. It's a 2-hour drive for me. That's if I have a meeting in Columbus, that's my entire day shot. Yeah. Right. And if I could be accomplishing something else, that would be ideal. Right. But the dystopian possibilities are they're a little spooky. I've heard stories about like the possibility of maybe free rides for advertisement. So like maybe you get in your autonomous vehicle, your autonomous Uber, and it says like, hey, if you stop at McDonald's, this ride's free. It's like, that's a little spooky. I don't like that.
Yeah, it could go really well and be a really cool solution for some of our transportation issues, or it could be really bad. Thank you for joining me for this episode. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and pick your brain about rural planning.
Thank you.
And we haven't even scratched the surface, I think, of topics that there are to discuss, and rural planning and GIS, and you know, we just mentioned autonomous vehicles, and you and I could probably talk about that for 3 hours.
Super purple, it's really down my bassy bright. Somewhere